Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Leisure Wheels podcast. I'm Gege van Rooyen, the road test editor for Leisure Wheels. And with me once again, I have Anzette Duplessis.
Good morning, good evening, hello.
And today we'll be talking mostly about the Range Rover Sport, which was launched earlier this week. And we'll also be talking some news from around the world, around 4x4s. But first, we just want to mention our competition again. We're still looking for a name for this podcast, so if you have any ideas, please let us know. Anzette, how can people enter?
Well, you can send it to our editorial email address. So just put Leisure Wheels podcast name in your subject line and send it to editorial@leisurewheels.com. Otherwise, you can use the contact form, which is on the website, or you could find us on Twitter. We're under Leisure Wheels SA, which is one word, and you can just tweet it at us there. And we've got a nice little prize for Christmas for the winning name chosen for the podcast series. So have a think about something relevant and 4x4 and nice and muddy and dirty and that. We've had a few interesting entries, but we want to give it another week, so let us know what you think.
I still like talking dirty. I think that's a cool name.
I think it has a lot of scope for being misinterpreted. That's my only concern.
All right, so like we mentioned, we'll be talking about the Range Rover Sport, but first let's just discuss some news. And most importantly, there was a report earlier this week that the Wrangler is actually losing its solid axles at the front and back.
This is very disturbing news. I mean, the new Wrangler is set for 2016, and if you think about emissions targets and that kind of thing, you can understand why they're doing it. But this is one of the few greats that is left, you know, the out-of-the-box, great value 4x4s.
Proper hardcore 4x4.
Exactly, and we've often said that the Wrangler is the best value for money, out-of-the-box, no modifications required.
Absolutely.
Capable 4x4, and this will completely change its capability. And while there's been no official statement, it does look like it's fairly on the money. And you can understand why they're going this route. It makes the vehicle lighter. It makes it more accessible for a greater amount of people. It's going to make it cheaper to produce and that kind of thing. But it is quite a sad bit of news.
It is. It's shocking. I mean, let's look at how it broke. Apparently, Auto News, they kind of interpreted what they saw online, which is ads for engineers to work on the 2016 Wrangler. And based on the kind of demands that they have of potential employees, it looks like they're focusing on a lot of electronic gadgetry and also on a lighter design. So based on that, they're kind of saying that it could happen. And there's been no official word from Jeep. So it's not 100% sure. So we'll have to see what happens. I'd actually be kind of surprised if it did happen. It does make a lot of sense. But I also think the effect that that would have on your kind of hardcore consumer and how they would respond to it would be very negative. And also, you have to look at the massive amount of money that's being made in terms of off-road kits, all kind of lift kits and suspension systems. And a lot of people can lose a lot of money because of this. So I'm not too sure that they'll actually do it. If it happens, I think we'll maybe see something along the lines of a Sahara and the Rubicon, where perhaps the Rubicon would still have front and rear solid axles. And maybe they'd go towards the Sahara with independent front suspension. But I guess we'll see. I suppose long-term it is going to happen. I don't think within 10 or 15 years we're going to see any vehicles, regardless of how off-road oriented they are, we're just not going to see them anymore. You don't have solid axles and front and rear diff locks and that sort of thing. But for now, who knows? We'll have to wait and see what happens.
The thing is, they haven't outrightly denied it either, which is what worries me. I mean, Chrysler's Jeep, the brand boss for Jeep, Mike Manley, has said that they didn't say, no, we're not changing it. They just said it's becoming difficult for them to make sure it meets all the standards that are required for it, in which I read things like CO2 emissions and how much it costs to
and
produce.
And safety as well. That's
safety.
Becoming a big issue.
It's becoming a massive issue. I mean, look at the Defender. So, like you say, it's probably coming, but I'd be very happy with something, like you said, Sahara and Rubicon distinction, where you can still get the hardcore solid axles, but it'll be a sad day indeed.
I mean, we drove the Rubicon for quite a while, and that was the 3.6 Pentastar.
Yes.
And that's a vehicle with like 200 kilowatts under the bonnet, and it's riding on solid axles. It's quite dangerous, I think.
Yeah.
If you're not used to that kind of vehicle,
definitely.
There's so much power. You take that onto a gravel road and you don't put it in four-wheel drive, it's quite risky. You have
it
to know what you're doing
around, yeah.
So maybe that's why it will inevitably happen, because from a safety perspective and just from a comfort perspective,
yes, definitely.
I mean, we like the off-road thing, but I think 95% of Wrangler owners very rarely actually do anything off-road.
It's for that one trip a year.
So, does it really make sense to have solid axles when for 95% of the time you don't actually need it? So, I guess we'll see. Anyway, on to some more news. Let's stick with the Wrangler. Our editor, Yanni Habst, he's in Las Vegas at the moment at the SEMA show. And he sent us some pictures of the vehicle that was voted the, what was it, the hottest
4x4 SUV.
The hottest 4x4 SUV of the show, which is, unsurprisingly, a Jeep Wrangler.
Yeah, it's a specialized one-off, it's project vehicle, basically.
It's called the Jeep Wrangler
Mopar Recon.
So it's really kind of a marketing vehicle for Mopar.
Yeah. It doesn't look as extreme as some of the things that Jeep has had at SEMA in the past. I mean, last year we saw that beautiful anniversary edition, which I still think is one of the most stunning special.
Yes, that was beautiful.
But when Jeep does special editions, they do it properly. They had the Polar edition we reported on 2 weeks ago, which is going to be available in America now. But this is a once-off. It's got a 6.4-litre Hemi engine, which I wish
we could
get.
Can you imagine what that would be like? Brilliant fuel consumption.
I want it, but I don't want to have to pay for the fuel. Yes. And then it's got the RockTrack transfer case, so it's got all the capabilities of a Wrangler and of a Rubicon. But it's got a 4.5-inch lift kit and 39-inch tires.
Can you believe it? They don't even look like 39-inch
tires.
They don't look
at
that big. They look like 35 or so. So that's a big vehicle.
It's massive. But it doesn't look as imposing as some of the other things. And because of the kit that they've put on it. They've put a massive bar at the front and that kind of stuff. It's all Mopar. So like you said, it's basically a marketing thing for Mopar. It's got door kits and different bumpers, a massive worn winch and a tire carrier on the back, and then nice high clearance fenders with rock sliders and corner guards for the corners. So it's properly kitted out, and it's just showing what you can do. I mean, you could say for the 6.4-litre Hemi engine, you could build this if you bought Mopar. And I mean, the Americans love kitting out their Jeep Wranglers. It's something we don't see enough of here, people embracing, but I think it's the fuel thing. So you're already spending so much on your Wrangler a month in fuel consumption that you don't want to kits it out even more. I mean, there's about 4 or 5 of nice Wranglers running around the country, but we don't celebrate our Wranglers as much as we should. Maybe now, with the threat of losing the solid axles, people will begin appreciating them a bit more. And then it's got a custom cream interior and all-weather slush mats and things like that. But it looks quite cool, so check it out on the website. It looks quite nice. And then you can check out the other stuff we have on there from SEMO that Yanni took photos of, you know, some on-location shots, and let us know if you think that the Wrangler can take the hottest 4x4 SUV award. There's a couple of nice
there are some
things
impressive things
at SEMA
this
year.
I like the Toyotas.
I like that F-350. Oh,
that is nice.
Nice big. We'll never get it here, but I mean, that's quite a fantastic vehicle.
We should mention, like you said, all this news is on our website, so you can go onto the website and read all about it. All right, last bit of news, and just sort of moving us towards the Range Rover. The Range Rover Sport actually broke a record recently. It traveled through the Empty Quarter in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, it's quite something. I mean, the Empty Quarter, we think about Dakar and how desolate it can be on the Dakar Rally, but it isn't really, because you have support teams and there's other races on the road, and you travel through several borders and several countries and that, whereas the Empty Quarter really is just that. I mean, it's a vast, vast area of... It's the second largest desert, and there's nothing.
And it's the largest sand desert in the world.
And there's nothing there.
There's absolutely nothing.
I mean, they had support teams, but still, there's no chance of anybody coming to find you.
I was looking at some satellite images of it. You can actually find it online, and it's amazing. You should just see endless sand dunes.
It's Earth's bald spot.
It's amazing.
It's the planet's bald spot.
And yeah, they broke a record. They crossed the desert in about 10 hours.
Yeah, it's 10 hours and 22 minutes, which if you think that they traveled a distance, they didn't do the whole thing. The whole thing is just over 1,000 kilometers. They did 849 kilometers, which is still a hell of a distance.
In a standard vehicle.
In a standard...
All it had were bash plates,
yeah,
I think.
Completely standard Range Rover Sport. So that's the same one we drove this week.
The 5-liter they did it.
They did in the 5-liter, yeah. And it took them 10 hours and 22 minutes, and which is quite the accomplishment. It goes from Saudi Arabia to the border of the UAE, and it's proper Dakar kind of territory.
Yeah, apparently this isn't really something that standard vehicles do.
No,
everything
not at
else
all.
That's traveled there are very proper sand-oriented vehicles.
And of course, they they did have the right kit in the sense that they had a Spanish driver who has done the Dakar for 10 years in a row. He's placed sixth as his best placement in the Dakar Rally. So he has a lot of open sand driving experience in that, and he talks a bit about the kind of skills and the kind of intuition it requires to drive on sand, and you can read what he says about the desert on the website. But it's quite interesting to think that you can set off on the 3rd of November and before the 4th of November you've traveled this massive
10 hours, which is not really that much.
No, it's not. This daunting part of the kind of the world that nobody does in a standard vehicle. And they did it in the 5-litre supercharged Range Rover Sport, I mean, which you can have.
Yes.
And you can put those bash plates on and you have the same vehicle that's done this. It does have 375 kilowatts in a V8 engine. So it's not really the kind of thing that you drive on the road every day, but it still is a legal road-going, publicly available vehicle, which is quite something.
And what was the average speed they mentioned? I think it was 80-something.
Something ridiculous. Yeah, 81.87 kilometers per hour, which is quite slow.
But considering it's only off-road.
Yeah, no, not through bad. That thick sand.
So, yeah, that was great.
Very special.
Clever bit of marketing.
Yeah, it's a series of challenges that Land Rover has set itself to do, and they're doing a couple of things throughout the year to show what the Land Rovers can do and what the Range Rovers can do. And I mean that the Range Rover Sport was also at Pikes Peak in June.
That's right.
And it set a record hill climb there. So I'd be interested to see what else they have up their sleeve. Mm. They also had those electronic, were they discoveries that they had?
Oh, they were, yeah. I think Range Rovers, actually.
Range Rovers that they had driving around as well to set a distance.
Yes, the record. Silk Route or something.
Yes, they did the Silk Route, yeah, the Silk Trading Route. It's also called Silk Road, but of course now Silk Road has all kinds of other. But they did the Silk Trading Route, and so they've got all these things they've planned. So it'll be interesting to see what they do.
They're
next.
Doing well at the moment.
They're
lots
doing very
new vehicles,
well. Yeah,
all of them very good, very
they
solid.
They seem to have sharpened their marketing strategy and their production lineup, and they're making waves. I can't wait to see what they build next because they've got a couple of platforms that they can work with, to get some new product out. Mm. So that's going to be interesting.
All right, so let's talk about the Range Rover Sport then. You were at the launch a couple of days ago, and it's being released officially a couple of days from now, on the 15th of November.
Yeah. So yeah, it was quite an outstanding launch. We know because you were on the international launch of the Range Rover Sport that they sort of borrowed it from the UK.
Mm, that's right.
But as launches go, it was quite something. What they did was they rented a scrap plane, a plane that was, you know, going to the scrapyard.
It's a big one.
Massive. And they rented it for the 2 weeks. The launch is 2 weeks. The media day was only the one day. So they got dealers and customers coming in. And they cut massive holes into the front sides of the airplane. So on the left where your stairway is that you usually go onto the airplane on. And then on the opposite end. And they build a ramp right through the front nose of the airplane, right behind the cockpit. So the car is sitting in business lounge because they left a lot of the plane intact.
Oh, yes.
So business class is still there. The cockpit was very eerie. They've pulled out all the electronics. They've obviously sold them all to secondhand parts. But you can sit in business lounge and they quickly put like a bottle of champagne and two glasses
it's
in.
It's exactly
and
the range same overseas.
I think they just stole the whole idea. Yes. But this Range Rover Sport comes driving past.
It's a great idea. No reason not to do it.
It is fantastic. And then at the back on the right near the tail, they cut another hole and then you come in through there and then down. You come out right in front of, or right behind the landing gear.
Okay.
So they had this massive precautionary thing there because if anybody came down there too fast, because it was about a 30-degree descent that you were coming
steep
down.
Sure.
And if you came down there too fast and took out the landing gear, the plane would just fall on top of you. So they were very worried about that.
Kind of worst case scenario.
Yeah, but luckily nothing went wrong on the day and everybody was very wild by it. It was quite, they left very little margin for error. And of course, the big tagline with the Range Rover Sport is the fastest, most agile, most responsive Land Rover to date.
Okay.
Which is very interesting because if you think about fastest, you're always going to think about the Range Rover. And you think about agile, you think about the Evoque because it's smaller but still fairly off-road capable. But it's up there. It's really, really good. And it's really, really quick. I'll get to the quick now, but what they demonstrated in the plane with leaving very little margin for error, is just how tight the turning circle okay. is.
It's and always how a big good issue the, with the big 4x4.
Exactly, yeah, and how good the approach and departure angles are. I mean, they measure that thing to show off perfectly, the vehicle. Yes. So it was never not going to do anything, but it's still fairly impressive. And the ascents and descents ranged between 27 and 32 degrees.
Jeez.
Which is a lot.
I don't know if they...
the bank as well.
I don't know if they did that on this as well, but in the overseas launch, what they did was they had an axle twister inside the plane.
Oh, no, no.
They had a massive axle twister where the wheels would actually leave the ground. So you would drive onto it, and then your front right wheel would actually be in the air. And they have all these Land Rover experienced guys around assisting. So he'd come up to the window, the guy, as the front right wheel is in the air, and he'd say, "So you've probably heard that this is quite a bit lighter. How much?" And if you paid attention, it's about 420 kilograms lighter than the previous one. And he said, "Well, just look how light it is." And he'd actually take the front and push it down so that it would tip, which was very cool. But
it's a nice demonstration.
Very nice demonstration. But proper axle twister in there. They had a defender.
They had a defender inside, and then you'd actually
go up against the side.
Oh, wow.
Kind of drive around the defender.
Yes, they did that. Mm. You drive up a quite a steep bank.
That's it,
And you drive around the defender. But they were obviously, because you guys had a bigger plane.
I think so.
I asked about the UK launch. I spoiled their little tag about this being the first time it's ever done. And I was like, "Didn't you do this at international launch?" Like, yeah, it was a bigger plane. It was a bit different, which it wasn't. But it's fine. It's still absolutely
still
amazing.
Still very cool.
But they had the axle twister on the 4x4 course. But well, like you said, what's interesting about this car is it's got that all-aluminium chassis. Mm-hmm. And it's a monocoque chassis, and it's 420 kilograms lighter, which is the equivalent of taking five people out of the car. That were traveling with you permanently if you had the previous Range Rover Sport.
Because
we should think about it like that.
The previous version was actually more of a Discovery Sport than it was a Range Rover Sport, because that was built on a Disco chassis.
Yeah, this is completely new.
And this is... It was sort of created alongside the full-size Range Rover, but it's not really stealing parts from the Range Rover. Apparently, 75% of the parts were designed specifically for the Range Rover Sport.
It's also got a completely bespoke suspension system.
It's an impressive suspension.
Where I think most of those parts come from. So they designed it from the ground up for the Range Rover Sport. So that's also completely new.
Let's chat about the suspension, because I actually think that's one of the most impressive things of the vehicle. It's the fact that you have something that, unlike just about any other vehicle on the road, it's designed to be sporty. It has to be agile and sure-footed around corners. You don't want too much body roll. You want it to feel composed around corners. But at the same time, this is something that needs to be off-road capable.
Yes, yeah.
And it's got articulation in total of over 500 millimeters.
It's absolutely insane.
But at the same time, you can do amazing speeds around a corner with it. It's very impressive.
Look, it's still largely road on-road biased, and from their tagline, you can see that they say that it's the fastest, most agile, most responsive.
Yes.
None of which has anything to do with off-road. There was a small off-road course on the launch, which by our standards was a bit of a dinky toy course, but it did it with flair.
Very easily.
It's got some amazing off-road tech, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But what was most interesting from a safety point of view for me with the suspension system and with the chassis setup is that their anti-roll mechanism and their damping setup can now control the front and rear axles completely independently of each other, which changes the way the vehicle reacts around corners and when you're braking and only one end of the vehicle is cornering and the other one's coming to
a
stop.
And isn't something like a few hundred times a second that it evaluates the situation?
It's
amazing. It's constantly
a bunch of computers, which doesn't exactly scream off-road. But I think on-road, you feel the difference. And if I compare it to the Porsche Cayenne, which it's coming closer and closer to, I still don't entirely feel like it's quite at the driving level of the Porsche
Cayenne. I don't think it can ever be. Not if they want to retain that 4x4 capability.
That's the problem.
If you want that articulation and you want a transfer case and all of that, it's going
to
be tough.
The problem is they want to be true to Land Rover, so it's always got to have that off-road capability and to a fair extent, even though people probably won't use it. But in terms of on-road dynamics, it's come a long way, and I think the weight has a lot to do with it. But like you said, that suspension system, which is completely independent, is quite something.
It's amazing. The lowest setting apparently it can be on is 50 millimeters.
Yes.
Which is like your enter height, just in order to make it easy to get into it.
Yeah.
And then the highest.
But you can't drive on that.
No, that's
like
just to get in.
Granny get in setting.
Which makes sense because if you're driving Range Rover Sport, you're probably in very nice
a nice
suit
dress
or whatever.
Yeah.
You don't want to like rub your legs up against the muddy side of
and
it.
And the highest setting, I couldn't get into the car.
That's 278, which is massive.
And considering we have that Navara, it was quite something that I couldn't get into this. We did the off-road course and then I didn't set it back down. And I tried to get back into the vehicle and I'm not the tallest person in the world. Okay?
Which is amazing, yes.
But it's the play between the lowest and the highest.
You've got your highest setting and then there are two separate settings.
Yes,
that each raise at another 35 millimeters. So if you're going over a rock or some kind of obstacle and it starts dropping down and it touches,
it'll lift back up.
It'll actually realize that and give it 35 millimeters more. And then there's a button as well, so you can add another 35 millimeters.
So it's a nice combination. This is what's different from the previous generation. It's a nice combination of manual control and automation. So automation. So the vehicle will actually tell you when it thinks that you've selected too low ground clearance or too high ground clearance for the terrain that you're on.
That's the terrain response system that they've now introduced.
And the terrain response system hasn't changed, but what has changed is that you no longer have to select which terrain
that's
you're
auto
on.
Now. You know,
you can actually, it still has that same center control dial, which you turn left and right to select the terrain, but you can now push it down into the control panel where it's flush with the control panel out of your way, and then it's in auto mode, and it'll actually sense whether you're going over rock or mud or sand or normal tar. And it will adjust the systems accordingly, but if it's beyond its scope, so if you've gone from tar to rock very quickly and it's only sort of adjusted at halfway, then it will tell you, please raise your ground clearance is too low. And if you do a manual override and the vehicle feels you're not doing the right thing, or say you're driving on 200 millimeters on an open road, which is unnecessary, then it'll tell you to lower the ground clearance, but it won't completely take over for you, which is a nice balance between the car doing the driving and you doing the thinking, I thought. You know,
what I think is very nice is the fact that you actually have two off-road settings, off-road 1 and 2. And the first one, normally in most of these vehicles, if you exceed 40 or 50 k's an hour, it drops all the way down. This one, in off-road 1, it's up to 80 kilometers an hour that you can actually do.
Which is far faster than anything
else.
Which
is great in terms of sand driving and that sort of thing.
I mean, that's because the diff locks, both middle and rear diff lock, are completely automated. So it can decide when to engage and disengage. And that's why it can do that. Because the vehicle protects itself from harm.
Yes.
And it knows what speeds each component can handle and what it can't. So that's quite cool.
The engines. What did you drive?
I drove both the 5-litre supercharge, which is...
That's got
it's delightful.
375 kilowatt.
I don't care. You've got to switch this thing on.
625 newton meters.
I would sit in it every day and just turn it off and turn it back on and turn it off. It's got this beautiful little grunt when you turn it on that just, I mean, they've proven not just with the plane and the launch and everything. I mean, this with this product that they're an exciting, you know, that they're still, I mean, they've always been, but that they're still an exciting brand. Because, I don't know, with Evoque, I think a lot of people like us who are more off-road biased than on-road biased, with Evoque, there was this concern that they're going very posh and electronic and not that exciting, you're sort of very mass market. But they are a niche product and they still do excitement. And this 5-litre supercharger, I mean, the engine hasn't changed.
Let me just repeat the specs because you were busy fawning.
I was so
excited. I couldn't really. That's 375 kilowatt and 625 newton meters.
625 newton meters of torque. And you go up these ramps on this plane and up until about a quarter of the way, which doesn't sound a lot until you consider the fact that it's over 30 degrees angle.
Sure.
It runs itself.
And what else did you drive?
It runs itself up. I also drove the 3-litre petrol.
Okay, that's a supercharged 3-litre.
Yes, which I only drove on the off-road track, so I didn't get to
too much
feel the dynamic of the on-road or anything like that. The 5-litre supercharger I did drive on, they did take us to the Rock Raceway on the East Rand, which is just a flat tar raceway that they use for drifting, and they had a high-speed top end and braking test straight strip, which was a lot of fun. I may have cooked the brakes a little bit. And then they also had a Gymkhana set up for us. And it's really impressive. The tests weren't terribly taxing on the vehicle. Again, they set these things up to show off the vehicle.
Yeah.
But I've done a lot of these lane change, emergency lane change, ABS lane change, Gymkhana kind of things. And you always get a little bit challenged by it. Whereas the Range Rover Sport, you know, it was like...
We did it at the UK. They had a landing strip where we could accelerate from zero up to 100 miles an hour.
Okay.
And back down to zero.
Okay.
And it did that in 16 seconds.
That's impressive.
All the way to 100 miles an hour and back to zero in 16.
They didn't tell us how long the strip was we were on, but I would guess that it wasn't more than 100 meters. Maybe 150. And I got up to 148-ish, 148 kilometers an hour before, you know, hitting the break point. And the only reason you brake is because you start running out of tar. And if you don't, you'll end up in the rough. But, and it comes to, but the they say 0 to 100 kilometers an hour in 5.3 seconds, which sounds impressive. But what was impressive to me was the stopping time. The stopping
time. The brakes are great.
I mean, if you consider how big that car
is. The weight behind it.
That stopping time is a hell of impressive. And the reason it is because of that 420 kilograms that they've shaved off. It makes a massive, massive difference.
It was amazing. When we were, a couple of months ago, we went to the anniversary of Land Rover.
Oh, yes.
They had a big anniversary do. And as a kind of a surprise, we got to drive the prototype Range Rover Sports at Gaydon on the test track, with the instructors next to you. And it's amazing because they know exactly what the limits of it are. So they're sitting next to you on this track and instructing you what to do. And you see this turn coming up
and you're doing literally
180 kilometers an hour. And they're saying, hold it, foot flat. And then all of a sudden they say, okay, now brake. And the moment you touch those brakes, they just kick in. And I was really impressed. It's a fun drive.
I think they were trying to impress us with the 0 to 100, but I was far more impressed with the braking time. Because 0 to 100 and top speed and that kind of thing are all very exciting aspects of a vehicle, but they're also wholly irrelevant in practical
usage. If you look at something like a little Fiesta ST or something, those are far more fun. Anything that's agile and fun to chuck into corners.
But what is important, I think, for ordinary drivers is how quickly you can bring this thing to a stop. If you're in a situation where you need to, you know, it doesn't matter if it can go 180 k's an hour. You never need to go 180 k's an hour. But you definitely now and then need to stop very quickly. And it was nice to see. It impressed me far more than any of the other tests. But then the dynamic lane change, which is where you go into a set of box cones. So they set up the cones to form a box so that your vehicle fits in perfectly. And then a set of red cones, which mean brake. And then to the right, as if you're changing lanes, as if there was something in the road in front of you, like a car that's come to a stop or been in an accident. And you do this at 60 to 75 k's an hour, which doesn't sound fast, but at
in that situation, kind of it is.
It's quite quick. And you race at this obstacle, which is these red cones, and then you come onto the brakes, you change lanes, and you see how composed the vehicle is. And that's where that anti-roll mechanism that they have is absolutely, I mean, the vehicle barely tilts. And what's also very interesting is that the first time I went through, I came onto the brakes, came off of the brakes and turned, because you don't brake in a turn, and that's how we're sort of, you know, taught on track and stuff. You never brake. The track instructors always bang this into you, don't brake in a turn, you brake before the turn. So the second time I tried it, I braked all the way through the turn. So I came onto the brakes as I exited the first box, turned the wheel, staying on the brakes, turned the wheel, went into the second lane, and then came off the brakes. And the vehicle keeps its composure all through the lane change, which for a vehicle of that size, and especially the orientation of how high and boxy it is really quite something. I was quite impressed with that. That's nice. And that's for me what brings it up to the level of the Porsche Cayenne a bit. Is that kind of maneuverability, and that's the agility that they talk about. And it's nice to see they've actually backed up their tagline. It really is quite the agile vehicle.
All right, so as we mentioned, the second engine is the 3-liter supercharged, and that's 250 kilowatt and 450 newton meters. And then you didn't drive the diesel, hey?
No, I didn't get a chance to, unfortunately.
That's 215 kilowatt and 600 newton meters. Suppose there'll be quite a market for that, but at this kind of expensive segment, I don't think people are that worried about fuel consumption.
No, not really.
And that sort of thing. So we'll probably see quite a few 5 liters running around.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The one I was least impressed with was the 3-liter supercharged. I suppose you didn't really get a chance to.
I just drove it on the off-road track,
It was quite high-pitched, and it didn't really go hand-in-hand with the kind of plushness and refinement of a Range Rover. Despite the fact that this is the sport, it just didn't feel that refined to me. It's quite a loud, rev-happy engine, and it gets quite tiring listening to that engine, because just a slight push on the accelerator and it starts making that sound. So I'm not too sure that I love that engine. The 5-liter or the diesel will probably be my choices.
And the price difference between the diesel and the 5-liter isn't that much either. And they've got the the 3-liter HSC, so the top spec, the diesel, at 1.15 million, yeah. And then they've got the 5-liter at 1.2.
Well, not much of a difference. 1.26. Mm.
So at that, I mean, it's a lot of money.
Mm.
But at that price class, that difference isn't a heck of a lot. And then the cheapest one, obviously, is that the 3-liter, the base spec, which is the S, the petrol, which is 824,000.
It's not a bad price. Not at all. For that. It's really, it's very competitive.
I will always worry that you can have a Porsche for that money, though.
Mm.
But I'm sure they're going to have absolutely no problem selling them.
But you have to wonder, like, is there any point to the full-size Range Rover?
I found this
one is so good.
It is.
It gives you so much.
And that's the challenge for them to balance out that, out that offering. And I mean, they're looking at another Range Rover. Mm. There's rumors of them using that CX-17 Jaguar platform. That. Which is an alloy platform, not an aluminium platform, using that for a Range Rover offering or a Land Rover offering to broaden the range, which
amazing.
It's got to be very difficult for them not to step on their own toes and steal from their own market. So you've got to plan your product so carefully in the segment, because people at this end of the segment, I mean, 100 to 500,000 rand difference isn't going to make a massive difference.
I think with the release of this one, the kind of Range Rover range that they started with the Evoque is now complete.
Yes, yeah, it's the last to get that family face, it's the last to get the aluminium chassis, so now they've finished off the luxury SUV family.
And it fits in nicely. You have kind of the Evoque for very affluent, kind of single people, don't really have kids, just kind of young yuppies. Then I see the Range Rover Sport kind of being aimed more at people in their kind of middle years. They just have kids.
Yeah.
For instance, some of the brochure material has a mountain bike on a bike rack on the back, which I think is very interesting to see who
from
they're
Range
aiming
Rover.
It at from a Range Rover Sport.
Because that's more a Land Rover market that they've always... It's interesting to see them pitching Range Rover.
I think they want to...
Market.
They want people to see this is a potential family vehicle. Mm. You don't need to be a drug dealer or a footballer to drive a Range Rover Sport. And then obviously you have the big one for... someone who almost doesn't really even drive himself. If you're finally at that level where you can just sit in the back and relax and you have a driver, then you buy the Range Rover.
Still amazes me that they sell the big boy Rangey. It amazes me in this market. But their waiting lists are full and they sell them. And I'm sure that their waiting list for the Sport is full as well. But I can't wait to see what they're going to do with that CX-17 chassis. And this, if this is what they come up with, for a product that already existed, I mean, giving them a clean slate.
Yes.
I can't wait to see what they build. I'm so excited.
We haven't talked about the transmission yet.
Yeah, it's got that 8-speed ZF gearbox that I absolutely adore. It's the same gearbox that's in the Amarok and the X5.
Surprising, though, that it doesn't have the 9-speed yet. So I suppose
it's
just
also
too
surprised.
Early. But I suppose next facelift, which will be probably be soon, a year or 18 months down the line.
It gives them something to change in the vehicle in a year or two's time. I was also surprised. I was really hoping they'd put the 9-speed in, because the 9-speed is, for all intents and purposes, it is finished. But I think that there's still some testing that they're doing on that and so on. Otherwise, they would have put it in. I'm very excited for the 9-speed. I don't even want to get started about it.
But there's nothing wrong with this 8-speed.
No, it's
very
lovely
good.
And it's got that, you know, that synthetic low range and that. So.
And of course, this is the first vehicle from Land Rover for a while that has the stick shift back.
Yes,
even though
so
it's an auto, it doesn't have that dial that we're used to.
No, it's got the stick shift and it's got three modes, which is nice. You can just drive it to normal and stick it in auto and it drives. Or you can use the shifter to shift,
just
which
give
I
you
love.
That sporty feel.
Yeah, I far prefer that to pedals. I hate pedals. You were not F1 drivers. Why are we driving with pedals? It's so silly. It's a pet peeve of mine. So you can shift it over and you can shift it up and down, or you can use the pedals. So it's actually got three options and that lovely...
Yes.
Hand gear shift. So that's nice.
And also, another change is a transfer case is now optional.
Oh, I missed that entirely.
It's on the press release. They mentioned that the international launch
What's
is
that going to cost?
So, I'm not too sure what that does to the pricing.
Sure.
I mean, in terms of the pricing that we got, it's not very clear to me.
No, it hasn't been included.
If
it
that
hasn't
price,
really been spelled out.
Does that price include or exclude a transfer case? Because it's apparently now optional.
That's very interesting. And that's going to make your vehicle a lot heavier as well.
Yes.
With that transfer case.
Because it was always, I mean, if you had a Land Rover of any kind, you knew it had low range.
Yes.
So now, suppose it's another weight saving.
Yeah.
If a lot of people don't need it, why put low range in there? Obviously, the ones you drove, if you drove it off road, they all had low range.
Low range, yeah.
So, I don't know, we'll have to check and find out.
I'm curious as to why they didn't market that sort of blatantly. Yes. That's something I would think.
Because I had a look on the local press release as well, and it's in there, but
we'll have to find out what that does to the pricing. Yeah. Another interesting thing that came up is that those those tires are expensive.
Oh yes, because weren't they specially created in conjunction with who's the tire company?
I forget, but Land Rover South Africa is actually buying a bunch of them.
That's going
to
be a hassle.
And they're going to hold them. They're not actually going to distribute them to retailers. They're going to hold them, and then you buy tires from Land Rover.
And if you lose a tire in Putsonerwater,
so you're thinking 6 to 7 thousand a tire.
If you can get hold of one.
If you can find one. So that's not great.
That's not great.
It's a lot of money. Mm. Thinking 20-something thousand rand, 27,000 rand.
And also at the international launch, they were mentioning the fact that this is a proper on-road, off-road tire. Mm. This is the only tire that you need, regardless of whether you're off-roading.
Well, it better be, because you're damn well not going to find one in the middle of Namibia.
But I think that is true in a country like the UK, where off-roading is you're on wet grass, you're on mud. That's the kind of thing.
And they have bogs.
So it's not something that's too tough on tires. No, you're not going to damage a tire on wet grass.
Here we have the Richtersveld.
Mm. So, I don't know. Those are very low-profile tires. Mm,
they are.
So, I don't know if I...
They're stunning, though.
They are nice.
But I don't know if I want to pay for them.
But then if you're going far off-road, you'd probably need to take 2 spares
along. Yeah.
And mentioning that, that's quite a significant change that we have over the international models, where they made quite a big deal of the fact that this is a 7-seater, proper 7-seater. Yeah. But we won't be getting 7-seat models here.
Because of the
full-size spare wheel. At least they realized that
South Africans are serious about
we want that full-size spare, which makes sense. If you're selling a vehicle with four-wheel drive, you need a spare wheel.
Yeah. So they can't fit the third row of seats.
That's right, because they fold absolutely flat. They're very great. I mean, they're very nice. You can actually get in there, but we won't be getting them. Anything else worth mentioning? The interior, what's that like?
They've simplified the dash, which I think is quite nice.
Mm, it's elegant and minimalist kind of look. Very nice.
It's uncluttered. It's very easy to navigate. All the usual real estate is there, but it's far less. It actually looks a bit plain, but it's nice. Mm. I mean, for something that can... You can fit a champagne bottle. They're very proud that you can now finally fit a champagne bottle into that little cooler thing.
And of course it's cool, It's actually cool.
Yeah,
so.
Because it's always been cool, but they've slightly increased the size now.
Okay.
So now they're very proud of the fact that you can put a champagne bottle in there. I don't know which champagne bottle. I mean, I'm sure they're all 750 ml. But so for something that's got so much opulence, it's nice to have something very plain in the front. They've also increased the rear leg room, and because, of course, it's longer. And
it doesn't look longer.
No, not at all.
The design's
I think it's that
brilliant.
Floating roof.
It's a very elegant.
Very, very.
It looks like a little grown-up Evoque.
It does. And there's no doubt that it's a beautiful car. Mm. And actually, I actually think it's far nicer to look at, far more attractive than the big boy Rangy.
Mm, I agree.
They had the three of them, the new family, standing in a row there. And the Evoque is stunning.
I find that with all of these, whether it's a Merc or a Range Rover, once you get to that size, even with a Land Cruiser 200, the dimensions become, it starts looking bulky and a bit fat and cumbersome.
It's difficult to make something that big graceful. Yes. Whereas, is what the Sport is. It looks graceful.
It's
that
graceful.
Floating roof is just beautiful.
So I mentioned last time that I thought this is still more Range Rover than Sport. Would you agree that it's still more towards the plush side and the comfortable side than the outright sporty side?
Yeah, look, it's not vulgar inside. It's not loud. I mean, the 5 litres is a bit loud. It's a bit show-offish.
Mm.
But it's not really the Rangy.
But do you think it encourages spirited driving?
No, I think it's more... Well, it's more Range Rover. Like you said, I don't think it's hooligan at all. That's what it's not. There's that sport element isn't really...
Yes.
It's not overwhelming. I mean, you feel it in the acceleration and that kind of thing, but it doesn't, with the
simplified... It's not begging something like a Grand Cherokee SRT8.
Yes,
that's just begging for you to just go crazy.
Down. No, it doesn't do that at all, and I think that's got a lot to do with the simplicity of the vehicle.
It's just elegant and effortless power. Mm.
You want to glide around. Mm. You don't want to go...
You have the speed,
down.
But...
From
most
robot
of the time,
to robot.
Yeah, you don't need it.
I think that's more the Rangy's business.
Mm.
But no, it doesn't have that vulgarity about it.
No, overall, I think it's a great vehicle.
It's a lovely
all-rounder if you have more money than some of our members of Parliament here.
Well, I think that kind of wraps it up.
Yes.
That's all we have to say about the Range Rover Sport. And thank you for listening to our second episode.
And remember to enter our competition. We want to know what to call our new series of podcasts. And if you have any ideas for our podcast, you know, what you'd like us to cover or things that you'd like to hear explained, some things are better in voice than in print. We're happy to add that to our repertoire.
Yeah, any kind of questions, whether they're technical, whatever, we're going to be getting some experts in.
Yes.
On vehicle fitment and on recoveries and whatever. So any questions, send them in and we'll have them answered on air.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gert.
Thanks to you.
Cheers.
Cheers.